Hello everyone, welcome to episode 170 of Connectivity. I'm Scott Thompson. Today we have two segments for you and then a bonus segment. Kicking the show off, myself, Zach, and Neil sit down to talk about Kirby and the Rainbow Curse. And after that, we have the audio from this week's Nintendo News Report with myself and Alex, where we break down Nintendo's lineup of spring games. And for the bonus segment, we have myself and Zach answering your dinosaur questions. Enjoy! Hello, everyone, and welcome to this segment of Connectivity. I'm Scott Thompson, and today I'm with Zach Miller.
Oh.
And Neil Ronahan.
Hello.
Wait, can't Neil, don't you have like a good Kirby?
Hi.
Name? There it is. I thought for sure you were coming in with that one. I like that you do that Kirby voice like 99% of the time when we aren't anywhere near talking.
I'll be honest, I realized after Zach responded, I was just like, I'm not going to do the damn Kirby voice. Just because I had a feeling that you would be like, what, you didn't do the voice?
Yep.
So mission accomplished.
You nailed it. and so today we are going to be talking about Kirby and the Rainbow Curse. Zach reviewed the game for Nintendo Report, and all of us have been playing it to some extent. And we're going to talk about it. Because it's pretty great, I think, or pretty good.
I'll do my little plug as well. I'm reviewing it for Nintendo Force.
It'll be
out, I think the next issue is mid-March. I know, my deadline for the reviews in like a week. I think it'll be out so that way we can have like Mario Party and Codename Steam reviews in the next issue. Or something like that. I don't know.
So yeah, this is sort of the spiritual successor then to Kirby and Kirby Canvas Curse, which was on the Nintendo DS.
Yep.
And I think Canvas Curse to me was sort of like one of those first games that was like, oh wow, this Nintendo DS is kind of onto something.
Yep.
You guys agree with that?
The first game I got where I was like, this seems well done.
You want to know something funny? I don't really agree with that because I didn't play Canvas Curse until like 2010.
Damn!
It came out in the era in which I was in high school and did not have a lot of money for games, which involved me, like, spending, like, $20 and getting a bunch of old retro games at the few Funko Land-like places that still existed at the time. But on my DS, I was too busy playing Yoshi's Touch and Go. Kirby Canvas Curse.
That's another good one too, though. That game doesn't get a lot of credit. Like, I know Canvas Curse really does get a lot of the credit for like ushering in the DS, but Touch and Go was very good as well.
Yeah, I mean, when I played Canvas Curse, I was not as wound as probably a lot of people were because I played it, you know, 4 or 5 years after it first came out.
Right.
And I played similar games like that. I think iPhones were out by the time I played Canvas Curse.
Right.
Like, I still enjoyed it, and it's still fun. But I do think that, I mean, it's definitely the most noteworthy game from that era that did touchscreen gaming right. But, like, I mean, Yoshi Touch and Go is the kind of game that if that came out on eShop on 3DS, like, right now, and it never existed 10 years ago, everyone would be like, this is amazing! It's like the next Pushmo! Blah! it's just that it was like a $30-$40 DS game in 2005 that people are like, this is overpriced because it was.
Yeah,
I agree. Touch and Go was very much overpriced, but Canvas Curse was very good. And yeah, you're right. I mean, I guess the novelty of the touch controls, touchscreen stuff specifically kind of wears off, especially if you have played any iPhone game to that point. but it was sort of revolutionary at the time and was proof of concept for the hardware.
Yeah.
I don't think that Rainbow Curse does anything like that for the Wii U, but I do still think it's fun.
It's the first game that uses the gamepad in like years.
since launch, yeah, probably.
Yeah, like,
right?
I mean, I'm just gonna be the asshole here who just keeps on interrupting things, but like, okay, let's think about this. Outside of Nintendo Land, I guess Nintendo Land and Lego City Undercover, outside of Rainbow Curse, has a Nintendo published game use the Wii U gamepad in a compelling, somewhat mandatory manner?
You can swap your items in Wind Waker with it.
To be fair, that was pretty awesome, but like that honestly might be it. Canvas Rainbow Curse just basically turns your system into a DS.
Correct.
Which is cool, I guess.
tragically, the top screen is what you want to look at.
Yeah.
And that is my biggest problem with the game. Because every time I look up at the TV, I'm like, this game is amazing looking. And then I look down, I think, this is so tiny and so much detail is lost.
Right. Yo, absolutely.
I mean, it sucks because I love having the bigger real estate to play the game on with having the bigger screen on the gamepad as opposed to the smaller screen on the DS. Like, I think that makes a world of difference because some of the times I would get frustrated during Canvas Curse, I haven't had any of those frustrated feelings on Rainbow Curse. And I think part of the reason is that, like, you have all of this real estate to work with. And
another part of it is you haven't gotten to the gondola stage yet.
Okay. I mean, granted, I'm still in the first half of the game, but even still, I remember Canvas Curse pretty soon to start.
I was
frustrated with it, and because a lot of it was because I didn't really know what was coming up ahead of me, and Rainbow Curse solves that by having a bigger screen to work with. But it's unfortunate because the claymation stuff looks incredible.
Yeah, so good. Like, and you're right, Zach. There's so much detail sort of lost. And to be fair, you can still see it on the gamepad, even though the gamepad's not as sharp. But really, because you're drawing so much and you have to be so quick, you know, most of the time.
You're not paying attention to it.
Yeah, you just can't pay attention to any of it. I mean, even if somehow you could play it while looking at the TV, I mean, it would be sharper and brighter. But I still don't feel like you would appreciate some of the nuance and detail going on with the claymation, especially in terms of like backgrounds and enemy characters and stuff like that, when you're only seeing them for really a second because you're quickly drawing rainbows to attack them or move past them, or, you know, do whatever you need to
do. Yeah, and I mean, that's just, it just kind of sucks because it's also the kind of game that like you need to be constantly involved with it.
Yeah.
There is no like, oh, I'm just going to chill here for a minute and just look at the screen on the TV because Kirby's a ball, and that ball moves, and you gotta control that ball from hitting harmful things.
Yeah, I will say, like, I've been capturing footage of the game and making some videos that will go up later and stuff like that. Rewatching those videos, not playing, is really great, because then you can be, I do catch all these little things that I missed the first time.
I watched some of the videos that you have been making, and I'm like, oh man, that's what the game looks like. This is amazing!
My brother came over and we switched places. I played as a Waddle Dee, and damn, that's a good looking game.
Yeah.
And playing as Waddle Dee is so much more fun.
Yeah, like
playing as Kirby.
I need to like coax Lauren to play, or like maybe I'm bringing this shit to PAX and then we can all play it. But I think that's kind of like the one thing that sets us apart from Canvas Curse that I think is a great addition is the addition of multiplayer. Because I mean, with Canvas Curse, I mentioned about how there were times where I would get frustrated with the controls and stuff, but in Rainbow Curse, if you get frustrated with the controls, just bring in a dude to play it normally.
Yeah.
Bring in a dude to carry Kirby around.
Yeah, like, it's like this really brilliant Nintendo-like way of kind of giving you, like, an easy button.
Yeah, for sure. And it's another one of those situations, kind of like the recent Donkey Kong Country games, where the second player has a little bit of an easier time than the first player, which I really appreciate, because then it lets players of different skill level play together. You know, Donkey Kong, Diddy, and Dixie, you know, they've got mechanics that basically let them float longer in the air and then kind of jump much more easily during the platforming segments. Whereas, yeah, here, I mean, Waddle Dee is just running around and isn't constantly having to be in motion and build roads and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. He just kind of hangs out. He's like, yo, Kirby, you be in that ball.
Yeah, and collecting items with a second player is that much easier.
Oh, my gosh.
That second player can just run up and grab them and not have to worry about, like, pinpointing a ramp to launch into the air to grab something.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. Those puzzle pieces can eat a lot of horrible things. Things yes, that Kirby should not eat.
Some of the challenge rooms are bitches too.
Yeah, but see, the thing about the challenge rooms is that they're a minute long. That's the thing about the challenge rooms. If you fail it, you're like, well, hey, I could replay that right now and I wouldn't be that pissed off.
True.
It's when you get to the end of a level and you're like, ah, finally, I got all the treasure chests. Oh, I gotta get this book page. Oh, I got the one star.
Yes.
Yeah, here's a pro tip for anyone out there collecting the diary pages. When you get to the end of the level, you can let Kirby just sit on the ground, and he won't really move around. Then grab a second controller and just play as Bottle D.
Seriously. That's an awesome idea. I'm going to start doing that.
I haven't done this myself, but my wife and I play together all the time. So I'll just sit there, and then she'll just stand on the platform, like right in the middle of it, and the diary page stops eventually at the middle of the bottom of the ring, and then she just jumps up and grabs it. So if you're by yourself, just let Kirby sit there, grab a second controller, become Bottle D, and then just stand there and grab it.
That is a fantastic idea.
And you will save
idea.
A lot of frustration.
Like,
yeah, because...
I'm probably going to go play this game after we start recording and be like, screw you, game.
Next time I see some puzzle pieces, I'm going to grab that second controller. That's a good idea.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Game the system a little bit.
Dude, yeah, because... I hate those puzzle pieces so much.
I guess, too.
Should we explain the puzzle pieces? Basically, it's like a... You know, like in a 2D Mario game where you...
I was like the red coins that have been popular in the new
where
Mario
like
games.
There is these, like, eight different things show up and you have to collect them while a timer is running. And
in, like, 15 seconds
or something,
yeah.
Then you can't get them. But imagine in a 2D platformer where you have really good control over Mario, it's you know, a fun challenge. But when you're a ball Kirby that you need to control by drawing paintbrush lines and you are on a time crunch, it's not as fun.
No.
Also, if you fail, you either need to commit suicide or start the entire level over.
Yeah, now that's the unfortunate thing. I mean, it's kind of a double-edged sword. I don't mind the level length. I kind of like that they're longer. But yeah, if you miss like the fourth treasure chest out of five, let's say, and don't suicide to like just restart from the last checkpoint, then yeah, you kind of have to replay the whole level all over again just to grab the treasure chest. And I've been doing that because I've been making these videos, and it's not that bad, now that I'm kind of doing it with a purpose, I guess. But I could see being kind of frustrated with having to go all the way through, like, a 20-minute level just to grab something. Because, like, you had it within your grasp but just missed it, like these puzzle pieces. Or, you know, one of those moments where you miss the chest, but then something comes up that impedes you from going back and backtracking to grab it.
And, yeah. and a lot of the later levels, I mean, they just kind of... I don't want to say they suck, but they're a grind to get through.
It gets hard.
It gets really hard. There's like a spike at level 5.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, it's a hard-ass game, and I don't want to replay those levels again.
Yeah.
And I don't want to get gold on every... That's the one that pisses me off the most. I can go back and get treasure chests, great. I can get the diary pieces, great. I don't want to have to hunt for stars.
Yeah, your best bet every time you play through level for the first time is just to grab as many stars as you can so you get the gold so you don't have to do that again. Because it's not as bad to go back to a level and just rush through it to get to that fourth treasure chest.
Right.
But if you're going through to like meticulously grab stars because you got the silver medal instead of the gold, then yeah, that becomes a little bit more of a grind.
Yeah, and Ryu's bosses suck.
Yeah, see, I'm on World 4. I just finished World 4, so I saw my first Ryu's boss. So, what are there, just three bosses, and they just repeat after the... Okay.
Because,
yeah, I just played the Wispy, you know, Wispy Woods again.
Although, the Wispy... I mean, the bosses are pretty cool, but I guess if they repeat, that is not cool.
Well, there's, like, a...
They're harder.
Yeah, and, like, so, you know, the Wispy Woods, like, the first time you fight it... He's just there kind of, you know, blowing stuff. And,
like,
yeah, exactly.
That's what it does.
And you just go up and hit him in the face. And I don't remember this effect being there the first time, but the second time you fight him, he's like made of steel. So you can't just attack him normally. You have to use Kirby's charge shot. So
you have to
grab enough stars first to even be able to like do damage to him. But once you hit him with it, you get like lodged in his face. So like his face gets smashed in because it's clay, of course.
Yeah, that's in the first fight too.
Is
but
it?
You don't
okay.
need to use it.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, you don't. So it doesn't have to happen, but if you use the charge shot,
yeah.
It happens.
Now I remember. I have not seen the second Wispy Woods, and I did that by doing the charge shot.
I must not have.
It's
done
still
that
adorable
the first time.
And like I'm gonna kill you tree way.
Yeah, I do like that. Yeah, he gets all like deformed, and then you're just tapping him to damage him. But yeah, that's. I don't know why they had to repeat the bosses. That is kind of unfortunate.
It makes it seem like this game might have been rushed.
A little bit. And I even kind of feel that way. I mean, the levels are long, but I'd almost kind of be happier with shorter levels and more levels. Because thinking about it, there's just six worlds, and then I guess, spoiler alert, there's a seventh unlockable world
what?
If you collect enough stuff.
What?
I believe that's what I read, yeah.
What?
That's what Zach just told me.
That's,
I'm going to take his word
for it. Wow, a secret world in a Nintendo game that's mind-blowing.
I know.
I mean, you ruined the whole thing for me. I'm
could only
stop
access...
Playing.
Oh, access by getting all the collectibles.
I mean, and then you got all the challenge levels too, and
the challenge levels are great,
pretty fun.
But I'm just saying, I mean, six worlds of three levels each, and then bosses that repeat halfway through. You know, I feel like that's kind of on the shorter side.
Well,
I'm kind of surprised.
What you could do is you could just split each level in half, and then you have all those worlds with six levels each, and it's probably a much better game.
Yep. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I kind of wish they would have just shortened the levels and just split them up.
And it's weird because some levels, like the tank level, are over way too quickly.
Then, I could have lived with more vehicle levels for sure.
Yeah, although I didn't like the spaceship, the rocket. The rocket thing was weird.
That's the weakest of the bunch for sure. I really liked the submarine. I was surprised.
Submarine's great, yeah.
The tank is the most adorable, but the submarine, I think, is the most fun to control. Neil, you haven't gotten to the submarine yet, have you?
I think the submarine... The submarine was in the E3 demo, so I have played the submarine.
Oh, okay.
And I did not enjoy the submarine as much, although the idea that it's, like, kind of reverse, and that, like, you're floating up as opposed to, you know, gravity.
That was
interesting. The tank is the best.
The tank is the best, but I like, too, that the submarine gives you a break from having to basically draw roads to be able to move. I mean, you just tap on the screen and Kirby actually goes to where you tap, which is kind of fun, and then you're actually just building the roads to direct your torpedoes. So it's kind of interesting and changes things up a little bit.
I wish they had more stuff like that, because it seems like, is there basically, like, one or two of each one?
So far, I've encountered two tank levels and two submarine levels.
And then one rocket level. So I'm sure there's one robot.
Yeah. I mean, if you think about it, what is it? There's like 25, 30 levels, and six of them are these kind of change-ups. I wish there were more of them.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. That's what I'm saying. Like more levels and more smaller levels would be great, because then you could do more of these vehicle levels.
You guys notice the little callback to Kirby's Dream Land 2 in the transformations?
Oh, yeah. Like, he'll be the hamster and the owl and the fish. Yeah, that is so awesome.
It's awesome.
I love that. I wasn't sure at first with the tank one, because I felt like it wasn't as obvious. Like, he gets colored like the hamster, but he doesn't, like, completely look like the hamster, I feel like.
The coloration is what immediately turned me onto it. And then I noticed someone mentioned it online. But the other two,
I mean, he, like, literally turns into them before then turning into the vehicle.
Rick the hamster, Koo the fish.
Koo the owl and Kun the fish.
Okay, yeah. My bad. Something with a K.
But yeah, I love that. That's such a neat little cute callback.
Makes me wish they were in the main game.
I know, yeah. That would be neat.
I guess, am I the only person that's rocked any amiibo help with this game?
Well, all I have is the Kirby amiibo, so I did use that, and I was like, oh, well, this is neat, but to me, the Kirby one just removes a lot of the challenge, because it just lets you use the charge shot anytime you want without having to collect the 100 stars. So I was like,
oh, that's nice.
It's nice, but I was like, well, I don't want to, like, abuse this and just become reliant on this. So I was like, if I absolutely need it at some point, maybe I'll use it.
It would probably be helpful for a boss.
Yeah, that's true. Oh, yeah. But see, again, that's that basically just turned on easy mode. I mean,
my issue with the use of amiibo in this game is that it's basically like a super guide, because the Meta Knight ups your attack. I use that one in a couple levels just to kind of mess around with it.
Does it give you Meta Knight?
Well, no. You wear the Meta Knight mask on the Kirby ball, and then like you have your attack power is increased, and you. Like, when you do the little, like, dash, it's faster and goes farther.
Oh, okay.
I only got DDD, the amiibo, today, but you wear DDD's dumb hat, and then I think you have more health.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah, and I mean, like, it's cool that they're in there and that there is a use for these dumb plastic toys, but I really think the implementation in this game is just...
Well, you can tell it's super shoehorned in.
Yeah. But I mean, like, and when you have stuff like how Hyrule Warriors does it, like, I think that's kind of like the way to use amiibo in games, and I wish more games did that. But I guess when you look at Rainbow Curse, like, where would they really go in? This was probably the only option outside of, like, designing an exclusive mode.
But yeah, I mean, I guess it's something a little bit better than just a costume change, which is nice. But, yeah, I don't really like the fact that all of them are just like, well, let's make this game easier. Because that's not something I really want. Yeah. I guess I like having it, like I said, like having that option with my Kirby Amiibo now is great. Maybe especially if I'm just trying to, like we said, get to like a fourth or fifth treasure chest that I missed and I don't want to like waste a lot of time. I could just charge shot through the whole level, I guess.
Yeah.
Without having to collect stars, which is, I guess that's nice. But other than that, yeah, I don't really have much desire to use them. Do you guys too have, Neil, you probably haven't gotten to a point yet where you've died a lot, but Zach, you probably have. Have you noticed
Level 5, just that first, the four scrolling sky level sucks.
Oh yeah, I died, that's where I first started dying a lot, was World 4. And if you die enough, it actually asks you if you just want to skip the level and move on to the next one, which I thought that was funny.
You know.
I didn't, I finished the level.
No, me neither.
Just Nintendo, talking about the Amiibo and the idea that they're kind of the super guide, if you remember back in the Wii era, there were all the, I think it was New Super Mario Brothers Wii might have been the first one that had the super guide in it.
Right.
Nintendo has gotten away from explicitly having something where it's like, you know, the gold Donkey Kong that comes in there and does the level for you. Like, that's kind of gone. But they still have those touches in it, like, you know, with the Amiibo helping you out. Or giving you the option to skip a level. And while, like, as a player myself, whenever I see that stuff come up, I'm like, fuck off.
I know, that just makes me more determined.
But as someone who would hit brick walls in games when I was younger, it's nice to know that, like, there's an escape.
Yeah.
Although I guess it's something that, you know, making our children soft pansies, et cetera, et cetera. But I don't know, like, I would have loved to have seen the end of Blaster Master as a child. But that game was hard as shit, so I didn't.
I would have loved to play more than three levels of Battletoads as a kid.
I mean, I had a Game Genie, so I think I did see the end of that game, thanks to that. But like, I wish I could actually, I don't know, see someone complete that Battletoads bike level somehow.
Oh, I've done it. I did it when I was little.
Can you do this shit at PAX East, please?
I could try. If they have Battletoads, man, I'll give it a shot.
We can record it.
I don't think they have, and well, I guess the Retro Room has NESs. Yeah.
If not, I'll find Battletoads. Well, no, why am I going to buy it there?
Write that down, Neil. Write that shit down.
I own Battletoads. I can just bring Battletoads.
Just bring it!
By the time you hear this, you'll have another week. If you want to recommend this really dumb shit to do at PAX East, let us know.
Oh, we're going to do some dumb shit.
We're going to play some Metroid Prime 2 multiplayer in the hotel. That has been decided. Which will just be, like, Zach and I laughing and everyone else being like, can we play Smash Brothers, please? And I'll be like,
dude,
I brought the Wii
player.
U. No, you can't.
Four-player Metroid
Prime.
Yeah,
but no one's going to want to play it because it's really bad.
It's terrible.
Anyway, Kirby. It's a fun game.
So that's Kirby. Zach, what'd you give it on your review? You gave it an 8, is that correct?
8, yeah. And I was really flip-flopping, too. It was going to be between a 7 and an 8. It was a 7 for a long time, but then I started writing the review, and I was like, there's actually a lot of stuff I love about this game.
Yeah, that's how I feel.
It's a game where, there's been some kind of shit on the internet about it, because some people gave it a low score, and people don't like it when people give games low scores. Having played it, I can totally see why there are people out there who would, like, give it a 5 out of 5 or a 10 out of 10. And I can also see why there are people out there that would give it like a 5 out of 10. Like,
well, for that one specifically, I read it and I felt like he was playing a different game.
I mean, it did.
That's just me. I mean,
I think it was a she, first off. But.
She. I thought her description was very like, the whole game's the same thing. And I'm like, not really at all.
Yeah, I don't think I would agree with that. I mean, on a fundamental level, yes. I mean, you're just drawing roads most of the time, but like
that's
environmentally,
like giving Call of Duty a 5 out of 10 because you're just shooting dudes for 5 hours.
Well, yeah. I mean, in Mario games, you're just jumping all the time.
Right, but that's the thing. Like environmentally, what you're doing in the game is impacted differently from world to world, just because of.
I mean,
like
that's
we
what
said,
I, that's what I noticed early on. Just small changes do a lot to differentiate each world. But no, I mean, it's going back to what I was saying. It is the kind of game that I could see someone being like negative and frustrated by it, you know, and some of the things that we might label as smaller annoyances being something that really bugs people. And I can also see people who are like, I don't really give a crap about, you know, seeing the cute claymation on screen. I just want to play this fun game. Whereas that kind of bugs us a little bit. I am not that far in the game as you guys are, but I have a feeling that when I sit down to write the review, I'll probably have a similar tone as to Zach's, because that's kind of how I'm feeling it right now, is that there's things about it that really bug me, but it's just a damn fun game.
Yeah, exactly right.
To me, like, the negatives are more like, they're more unfortunate than they are bad, you know? Like, oh, you can't really appreciate the look of the game. Like, well, that's unfortunate, but that it's not bad to me. It doesn't ruin my experience. And the longer levels, too, like, maybe kind of detracts from wanting to replay them. But my first time through, I'm having a lot of fun, you know? Yeah. I have no problem getting through the levels the first time, and they are all fun, if not very difficult, as you get to the second half of the game.
I think it's a bit of a completionist's hell.
Yeah, it's going to be for me.
Yeah, I mean, that's what, like, I don't know if I'm going to go back and try to get all the treasure chests. Like, the first time through, like, I missed one on the first level and then just kind of was like, you know what? I realized I had already seen some people complain about the level length and was just like, you know what? I'm just not going to worry about it. Like, if I come across a treasure chest, I'm going to still look for them because that's how I play video games generally. But I don't want to get to a point where I'm replaying levels to try to collect everything. Like, that's part of the reason why I still haven't finished Donkey Kong Country Tropical Freeze, is because I haven't given up the completionist torch yet. And I'm like sitting somewhere in World 3 because I just keep on going back and trying to get everything. And I'd rather actually see the end of Kirby and then think about going back. Like, I mean, it's a whole kind of dilemma, because there is a part of me that just wants to 100% the whole game as I go through it. But there's also the part of me that like, nah, I just gotta play through it. I just gotta enjoy it.
Yeah, I don't think you can go at it that way. I mean, when I play these games, we all, you know, my wife and I, we always end up completing everything, whether it's New Super Mario Brothers or Donkey Kong or what have you. But yeah, no, you'll burn out if you try to just replay the level like 5 times in a row to get everything. Like, you need to beat the game and then come back. I find going through and beating the whole game and then coming back to get things I missed, I kind of get an appreciation for the older, like the earlier levels in the game. Because yes. I'm like re-remembering them, and I'm re-experiencing them. I'm going, wow, you know, this early level was actually really good. I forgot about this because all I remember now is like...
And now you're better at the game, so yeah, it's not exactly as painful.
And, exactly. And this is the kind of game that just, I mean, the act of playing the game makes you better because it's not something that you do often.
It's a very good game. I like it a lot, and I'm going to beat it. I might 100% it, who knows, but... And I might get that D2D amiibo or Meta Knight, because he looks pretty awesome.
Dude, you're never going to find him.
Well, yeah, you won't.
I'm going to go to Best Buy tonight, motherfucker. All
you're
right?
Not going
to
find
I'm going to get my $10 Yoshi amiibo.
There you go.
Okay, yeah, I mean, like, that'll be there, Knight. Because they fucking discounted it, because they can't get rid of him.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we could just talk about amiibo and how fucked this situation is.
We're not going to go into
it. I pre-ordered Ike in December, man, and the GameStop only got one.
Oh.
There were like a half dozen pre-orders in that store, and they only got shipped one. I was the second person who pre-ordered it 3 months ago.
Because that shipping, that cargo strike.
Yeah, no,
on
that's what they were telling me.
West Coast.
So, there you go. That's Kirby and the Rainbow Curse / Amiibo sucks. So hopefully you're playing it. I think it's very fun and very worth playing. Keep an eye out on Nintendo World Report's YouTube channel.
And WRTV.
And there you go. We are going to be having a video series go up there, actually showing you where you can find all those treasure chests. So if you're having trouble finding them, or maybe you want to watch those videos ahead of time so you don't have to replay these levels 3 or 4 times, which, as you've heard us say, is probably one of the few drawbacks to the game. So you can avoid that and go in knowing exactly where everything is you need to find right from the start. So keep an eye out for that. Should start up, on Monday, I believe. So.
Yeah. Honestly, if I try to 100% this, I'll be using those videos.
There you go.
So perfect. Thanks, Scott.
No problem. All right. Thanks, guys. We'll talk to you guys later.
Bye.
Bye.
Hey, everybody, and welcome to a brand new installment of Nintendo News Report for Thursday, February 26, 2015. During the show, we discuss recent Nintendo news, as well as this week's new release and more. I'm your host, Alexander Clothby, and today, no special guest. I am joined by Scott Thompson for a fun live show.
That's like the best introduction I've had. No special guest. We have Scott.
This will be good enough. So the thing was, for this week, there wasn't a ton of Nintendo news until today. And there wasn't really anything that we could put at the front of our show as our super, super duper thing worth leading with. So instead of doing like Tingle's gay and making that the top story, we're instead deciding to do the Spring 2015 preview. We're going to be talking about a lot of the games coming out through May, and hopefully it's going to be a real fun old time. So we have this list of about 7, 8, 10 games. I think we're only going to focus on like a few of them especially, but this is just a list of the general stuff that's coming out through May. At the top of it, coming out in like a week, we got Mario vs. DK Tipping Stars. DK Tipping Stars coming out on March 5th. That is Nintendo's first cross-buy game, 3DS, Wii U. It's made on their framework platform. It seems like another one of those mini marching games that are usually okay. Are you going to get this, Scott?
No, I'm not a huge fan of the Mario vs. DK games. I liked Donkey Kong 94, which I know was one of the ambassador games, if I'm not mistaken. But I've never really gotten into this series. I do like that it is cross-buy. Like, that's pretty neat. Of course, it's handled in a weird way because, isn't it, you get like a code to download it on the other platform when you buy it on one.
Yeah, it's not actually cross-buy, yeah.
Because it's not like account link, so presumably you can just give your code to someone else and then they can download it on a different platform.
I don't know if that's good or bad. The thing about that I'm a little iffy on is that it seems like Nintendo has some knowledge of which code goes on what system. Like which code is used on what platform. Like, I'm pretty sure that Nintendo will know if another Club Nintendo account uses a reward intended for another person's Nintendo Network account. I don't think they usually act on it, but I think they have the knowledge of that if they want it. Do you remember hearing anything like this?
Yeah, I mean, in fact, I even wrote a news story for Nintendo World Report probably over a year ago now, where I think it was that promotion they were doing where if you got Fire Emblem, it was some of Fire Emblem and then Shin Megami
Tensei 4. Yeah.
Wasn't it if you bought both of them, you got some like eShop credit or something like that?
$15?
Yeah.
Or is it 25? It was a lot of money.
It was a lot, yeah. I think it was 25. It was substantial to the point where it was like it almost paid for one of the games entirely. But you had to register both games with Club Nintendo and that gave you a code for it. And I remember I interviewed someone who had two Club Nintendo accounts when you're not supposed to. And, like, tried to do it twice, and somehow Nintendo, like, tracked it based on, like, redeeming the codes on the same hardware twice. And, yeah, and then actually, like, ended up pulling all her, downloads, everything she used to download all the games she downloaded with that $25 credit, I should say. They, like, pulled their rights from, so she couldn't actually play the games that she had downloaded and couldn't download them again. So that was pretty wild.
Right. So the general point here is that I think there's a chance that maybe they could say, there could be this message saying this code is not intended for this system if they really wanted to. Mm. But it also seems like Nintendo is also pretty laid back, when it comes to this stuff. Like, it's technically in the TOS. You're not technically allowed to give your Club Nintendo games away, and you're not technically allowed to do all these exploits, but like, I don't think, like, you've heard of this Wii Mini exploit that's going around Club Nintendo, where people can actually make up these codes for Wii Minis, and that you can actually get, like, 700 free coins per account via this kind of
shit.
Oh, really?
No, I haven't heard that.
Oh, it was a whole thing. You can't do it anymore. But there was this thing where, like, if you put these numbers, and then you do, like, any combination of 9 numbers you can think of, and then it's within 10. There's this whole system. It was extremely easy to get like 7 surveys using like the Club Nintendo family account. And I had some fun with that. it's thank you for those Duck Hunt posters, Nintendo.
Wow.
But it's
you were getting arrested today.
Yeah, the SWAT team is going to break down my doors. No. It's so I don't think people are actually going to get caught for that. It's more Nintendo's nature to just go like, hey, we're just not going to allow you to use Wii Minis anymore. Because imagine if they did ban thousands of people who were using this exploit. Like, it almost wouldn't be worth the trouble for a server, a thing that's a site that's closing down.
Yeah.
It just seems like Nintendo's probably going to take the passive route, and either they'll not care, they're happy people are paying attention to the game and even buy it. Because even if, a lot of people are turned on to the idea of, let's split the money halfway and then we'll each take one code, that'll probably still be positive for the series sales.
What was I say? What's really, there's no harm in, your friend playing the game as well, right? Like, there's no real downside to that. If your friend was never going to actually buy the game himself, you know, like I don't
at least otherwise, yeah,
right, you know, so I don't know that it's a losing situation if people are giving their codes to friends. So I've got no real issue with it.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I said I would not get this game, but if someone was to give me their code, maybe now I'll play it.
It's also, just before we move on, the 3DS game that came out, if you're on Club Nintendo, you're looking for a game to spend your points on, you already got the Harmonites and all the physical games. The 3DS Mario vs. DK game, where it's kind of like that that pipe thing, and it's different from the other Mario vs. DK, that game's yeah. real, real good. I actually recommend that one if you're looking for something to play. Moving on, Codename Steam is March 13th. I have not played the demo yet, but I am still excited to buy it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I haven't played the demo yet either. I was specifically waiting for the new 3DS, and I have the new 3DS, and I've just been, way too busy to even
bother
at this mm-hmm. point. And now we're so close to it coming out, I'm like, well, I'll just wait. Like, why spoil anything at this point? But no, I mean, I love strategy games. I love turn-based strategy. You know, and at first I was just like, oh, it kind of looks a little bit like Valkyria Chronicles, which I adore. So I was like, yeah, I'm totally into this. So
it's the fact that other people are excited about it, and the fact that Intelligent Systems, the maker of Paper Mario and Fire Emblem and Advance Wars, are making it. Do I really need to play the demo? If there was right. a demo that came out, does that affect whether I'm going to buy this game as soon as I see the review? Like, no. So what's the point? It's an right. exciting game. And I think it's just so cool that Nintendo's putting this focus on like these more Western-styled Japanese games. Like, it was this one, and then Harmonite was also a similar game, where I think someone from the UK actually came up with the concept for Harmonite eventually, mm-hmm. and then Game Freak in Japan actually ran with it. I think that's from the Iwata Asks. So I think it's cool that Codename Steam looks like a Western game in some ways more than a Japanese game. Right. Not that's not to say one's better than the other, it's just like it's different for Nintendo, and that's cool.
Yeah.
Fossil Fighters Frontier comes out on March 20th. I actually just rewatched the trailer for that. That game seems really simple. And mm-hmm. it seems like, so you get fossils by exploring this land. You get these really cool-looking dinosaurs, or vivisaurs, I think they're actually called, and then you pit them one against another in this monster-battling, hopefully Pokemon-style combat. And I've never played these games, but if they do really well, if they review well, if other people say, hey, this game's really awesome, I'm not against another monster-fighting RPG. Are you, Scott?
I'm not against it, but it doesn't really do anything for me. I have a hard enough time trying to get through the Pokemon games, let alone what at least in my head is a knockoff Pokemon game, even if that's completely unfair to the series. I know people do love the series, and it looks all right. Like, the trailer looked fine. It doesn't look like a bad game, but this, as much as Codename Steam is absolutely for me, Fossil Fighters is the complete opposite and just not for me.
Right, and in worst case scenario, it's worth noting that despite the fact that it doesn't always look like it from the cover, Fossil Fighters is actually a Nintendo series. It's a really Nintendo yeah. series.
Yeah.
That I think it's actually made by their SPD group, but I'm not 100% sure on that. But either way, that's coming out. That seems relatively cool. Mario Party 10 comes out on March 20th. It's we're going to be talking about that a little more later. I'm not interested in Mario Party because 90% of the games I play are solo, but you have a wife, Scott. You have some young kids. You have friends. Yeah. Are you going to buy Mario Party 10?
You know that F word I hear so much about Friends. Yeah, no, I'm totally gonna get it. If you talk to Neil and I, like, we absolutely love Mario Party 9. I feel like Mario Party 8, I feel like a lot of people played because it came out early on the Wii and everyone was all about the Wii, so I felt like it was pretty natural for people to grab it. Mario Party 8 was really bad. Really, really bad. Like, just terrible motion control thrown in there for no reason. It looked really bad. But 9 was great. 9 was a lot of fun in, like, the most, like, basic Mario Party ways, so I'm all aboard with 10. Yeah, I'm definitely going to get it and hopefully have a lot of fun with it, so, yeah.
So let me ask you about 9, then. Did the fact that all the characters were moving at the same time, did that affect Mario Party for the worse at all?
Some people complain about it, but yeah, that was the whole, like, conceit of the game, is, yeah, you travel together the whole time, which I thought allowed them to do cool things, because now, rather than just travel around the same board in a circle for, you know, 15, 20, 30 turns, whatever you set it to be, you're traveling together from start to finish. So they were actually able to do, like, more kind of Mario influence. So halfway through the board, you would fight a mini boss that would be like a piranha plant or a bullet bill or something. And so whoever ended up getting like the killing blow on the mini boss got extra coins, and there were different things like that. And then at the end of the board, you fought that board's main boss, which would then be some bigger Mario, you know, universe boss. So it was really neat. I thought it was really well implemented, and yeah, really cool. So I like that.
Cool. So that's 320. And then Story of Seasons comes out on March 31st. That is the Harvest Moon-esque game, or it's actually straight up the next Harvest Moon game, because the last one just came out. The one that's... So you know how that whole situation went with the Marvelous, and then, like, the X-Seed, and then it's this whole messed up thing. The next Harvest Moon game is not called Harvest Moon.
Right, they can't use the name.
March 31st. Right, because this whole, like, weird conflict that happened with the last Harvest Moon. So now we have two Harvest Moons. One of them's, like, the weird Minecraft-looking one that was just released by... Natsume. It's Natsume and X-Seed, who is Marvelous. So Natsume put out their own Harvest Moon because they didn't have the right to the actual physical games anymore, but they had the right to the name in North America, and then X-Seed Marvelous had the right to Harvest Moon, so they ended up, they have, like, the rights to the games, so then they ended up making their own Harvest Moon and didn't call it Harvest Moon in North... It's so weird, but this is the next Harvest Moon game. There you go.
I think your roommates find this whole situation very hilarious.
Is that distracting?
It's not distracting, but I think they are very amused by this Harvest
Moon
situation.
Oh, yeah, it was pretty well-timed.
What a mess.
What a mess. So next up, we got Devil Survivor coming out on May 5th, Devil Survivor 2. It's probably called Overclocked again, or it's called Over Something. That's the sequel to that game that came out, like, soon after the 3DS's launch by Atlus, the Shin Megami Tensei Devil Survivor, which are in both these games are based on DS games. I remember about the original Devil Survivor that a lot of people complained about it because it had no 3D in it, and it was right after the 3DS's launch, and it was a whole thing. And nowadays, like, there are plenty of games like NES Remix that come out and just have straight up even less 3D than the 3D cutscene they included at the beginning. So that's fine. And then Atlus does a sale on 3DS every few weeks.
So this game will surely be like $15 within the first 3 months.
It's $15 in every single sale they do. It's without exception the first game. So if you're interested in Devil Survivor 2, you want a Shin Megami Tensei game that's also a strategy RPG, you can get it for $15 probably next week. And that's based on no news I have, but it'll probably be next week.
Yeah.
So it's there you go. Hatsune Miku, Project Mirai Remix on 5/26. That's coming. And that is the latest Hatsune Miku game. Here's the thing. I really like the Vita games, the Project Diva F and Project Diva F2. The first game is absolutely fantastic, excellent soundtrack, excellent rhythm game gameplay. And it's great on the Vita because you can have your headphones and then no one actually has to watch you playing the waifu game on the big TV.
Yeah, I remember you talking about that, yeah.
Yeah, so there's that, and It's, and I think the second game, because there's the whole Vita anniversary sale this week, I think you can get the second game for like $20, which is real, real good for a really hefty rhythm game. So if you have a Vita, those games are super awesome. I heard this game, Project Mirai Remix, is even better. And it doesn't seem to play exactly the same way. Like, it has like that weird note-dragging thing that Theater Rhythm and Elite Beat Agents have, though I don't know if it plays the exact same way. And then it's like a more chibi art style than the games on Vita and PS3 have. But these rhythm games are fantastic. They're some of the best rhythm games you can get. I'm really excited about this, and that's the reason why I focused on this one as like the only main non-Nintendo game I'm actually focusing on. Like we just skipped over like briefly Story of Seasons and Devil Survivor. I'm actually really hyped for this. Have you ever played a Hatsune Miku game, Scott?
No.
Okay. Any interest at all in a real good rhythm game?
We'll see. I don't know that I will love the aesthetic. I mean, when you describe it as a waifu game, I don't know that really.
No, it's more than that. Like, it's not like these hyper dimensions Neptunian.
Oh man, we get emails for those, like PR emails for those every week, and I'm at work, and I know like I can't open this at work because I know like I'm just gonna be lambasted with like half-dressed anime girls, and I can't.
And like I joke about this being a waifu game because like the Hatsune Miku and all her stupid friends look like waifus, and don't get me wrong, if you go in the 4chan threads, they really are the waifus. But like it's more than that. Like it's charming and like sweet and like kind of like adorable. Like it's not as blatantly like offensive as a lot of the other ones are. It's just young kids having fun. Like there's no undertones that aren't created by the outside audience.
Yeah, right. Well, I mean, I do enjoy rhythm games. I guess if there was, on the off chance there was a demo, maybe I would try the demo and see how it fares.
And there often is. Like, I think the Vita game has a demo, or the Vita games, so there you go. Right. And then the last, particularly largest game we're talking about, Splatoon, is still announced for a broad May release. I have not played that yet because I was not at E3, but I'm going to be at PAX East, which we'll also be talking about later. And I'm really looking forward to trying it. Scott, you played Splatoon, didn't you?
Nope, I have not played it.
Oh, you weren't at E3 either, so we're completely uneducated.
I'm very excited. Well,
yeah, because it looks like a real cool game. It looks like, because everyone was always talking about, like, when's Nintendo going to do their shooter? When are they going to have their attempt at a shooter? And as I've said many, many times in the past, Splatoon is Nintendo's Pikmin for the Wii U. This is their new franchise. This is the big new video game player-focused franchise. And based on that fact alone, I'm really looking forward to seeing what this is and how it turns out. Now, it seems like it's going to be multiplayer-focused, and it probably won't have that much of a single-player campaign.
Right.
At least that's what it sounds like based on what people are saying. So I'm skeptical. I'm going to wait until seeing what the early impressions are. But I think it'll be cool. You're going to buy Sight Unseen, Scott? Well, not totally unseen, but...
Well, I mean, if reviews come out and like it's like being lambasted, then no, I won't jump in. But assuming that it's at least like good, then yeah, I'm all for it. It looks like a lot of fun. They had showed more in a recent Nintendo Direct, and you kind of get the hub world. Kind of reminded me of Destiny a little bit. So it's like at between matches, you can buy all these like outfits and different equipment for your characters and then use those in the battles. Which looked pretty cool. The one big concern is we had an article, a preview from Famitsu come out, and it was hard. The translation's hard to really tell, but there was something about voice chat not really being present either in the game at all or at least partially. So there's differences of opinion based on the translation. It could be that there's no voice chat whatsoever, which would be terrible for a game like this, or it might be that you just can't voice chat with like random people that you don't know, so people that aren't your friends list. And even that is kind of a bummer because, I mean, yeah, you can play matches with all friends, but more than likely you're going to be playing with people on your team who you probably don't know. And like to not be able to coordinate and work together through voice chat is to me a big letdown for a game that is entirely focused on multiplayer.
Yeah, it's kind of a crazy debate. It's personally, I don't remember the last time I've played a multiplayer game with randoms. Like I'm pretty sure in the last 3 or 4 years, every single multiplayer session of any single game I've played has been over Skype or in party chat in whatever system. Mm-hmm. Which isn't, listen, more choice is always good, and it is, it's a negative thing that it's not included here or won't be included in some context.
Right.
And there's still a few months left. There's still some time for Nintendo to see the decision and, like, announce on Nintendo Direct, like, hey, we heard you guys talking about this. We are actually going to do this, and we're going to actually have all the voice chat you want.
And honestly, it's not that much of a fundamental change that it couldn't even be patched in later. So, like, even if it's too late now to go in and change it, it's not the kind of thing that, like, a day one patch couldn't add in, you know, or a patch shortly into the game's lifespan, so... I just think it's crazy. Like, I get the fear of, like, kids communicating with adults, and maybe that's a weird situation, but I wrote an editorial about this, and I mean, a system-level function of the Wii U is video chat, in which you can video chat with just anyone you friend through Miiverse, and you can friend anyone and not know who they are, because all you see is a little me, and then all of a sudden, you're 12, and you're talking to, like, a grown-ass man. Video, like that's a bad situation. Like that's okay, but you can't like talk in Splatoon for 20 minutes in a match and then never see the person again. It's kind of weird to me.
Yeah, it is. It's a weird thing. Hopefully Nintendo figures it out, and then hopefully Splatoon. Hopefully all these games end up being amazing. Just quickly before we move on, I'm guessing we'll be in agreement here. But is the most exciting game out of all of these not codenamed Steam? It's if we had to pick a winner of which game we're the most hype about out of these spring 2015 releases, I think we're both going to say codename Steam. With Splatoon is second.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Like, Mario Party will be fun, and I guess I really wasn't all that on board with everything else. I know you've got some more that you like a little bit more than me, or at least more interested in, but
yeah.
Codename Steam for sure is number one. I think it helps, too, that I'm just so excited about the new 3DS. Like, I can't wait to have more games to play on it, so that helps, too.
Excellent. Moving on to new releases. Donkey Kong Land 1, Donkey Kong Land 2, Donkey Kong Land 3, Donkey Kong Country 1, Donkey Kong Country 2, Donkey Kong Country 3 all came out on the virtual consoles for Wii U and 3DS today with a bonus sale. Buy one of these six games and get 30% off Returns 3D or Tropical Freeze. I want Country 1 through 3 on 3DS more than anything else.
Which
but
you won't
it's
get.
So cool. It's so cool that these games all came out and like with pretty much no announcement beforehand. Just we knew they were going to be coming sooner or later. We knew there was going to be something, but it's real cool that all like the whole series, they didn't space them out at all. They just threw them
right.
all on the
I love this move. Like I think how like about how the Mario games have been doled out, how the Mega Man games across both platforms have been doled out. Like I love this approach to just here you go. Here's like six great games all from the same series, like, have at them, you know, pick the ones you want. We're not going to make you wait. Like, if you really love 3 for some reason, you know, Country 3, we're not going to make you wait, you know, 6 weeks to get it. Here you go. It's here right alongside 2 and 1. That's fantastic. And I kind of hope that the sales support them moving forward with this approach. Like, it would be great to just, every now and then on a week, you get, like, 5 Mario games or 5, you know, games from the same series or even 5, you know, notable virtual console games in general because we don't even really get that anymore. So
right. We have space for that too. Like, I don't think a single Wii game has come out as part of this thing since the original 3, at least in North America. I don't know about the other territories. And I think we're overdue for a week like this where, like, 5 Wii games come out.
Yeah.
That's really cool. Which one of those is your favorite out of the six games? I think Country 2 is the best game overall.
Oh yeah, Country 2 is easily the best. I joke about Country 3. It's actually pretty good. It's not bad. It's probably better than 1. I'm not a huge fan of 1 anymore. Time hasn't been too kind to it. I feel like 2 they really refined it. And then the Donkey Kong Land games, I had all 3 of them as a kid, but I can't remember them as fondly, but they are all like good. They're, you know, they're fine games and they're different. Like they do have unique levels and everything. It's not like reprints of the Donkey Kong Country games just on the Game Boy.
So. Okay. So they didn't pull a Mega Man and like make it like this handheld approximation of a console game. Like, these are literally 100% total new games.
They are still very much trying to capture the essence of the country games, but no, the levels, it's entirely different levels. I mean, same settings, mind you, but they are different.
Okay. Cool.
They don't look great. Like, you need to brace yourself for that. Like, they were really trying to capture the art style of country, and it doesn't, I feel like it doesn't work great on Game Boy. So just, you have to be braced for that, but.
Let me ask you then, all 8 Donkey Kong Country games have been in discussion as part of this week's new eShop releases. What is your favorite, including Returns and Tropical Freeze? Is it still, do we still think 2 is the best one? Or do you think these two actually add a little bit of a difference to it? I actually think Donkey Kong Country Returns is my favorite overall.
Tropical Freeze is my favorite overall. Because I just love the inclusion of the other characters. And the music is just so much better. And I feel like the level design's a little bit better, too. But both Returns is very good, too. See, like, Country 2 is the best of the Country games, but by today's standards, like, they're very difficult. A big draw was the look of the games back on the Super Nintendo, the fact that it was able to pull off that look, and it doesn't look great now, especially on a TV. Like you said, Country would almost be better served on 3DS, because the sprite work wouldn't look as bad blown up on an HD TV. I'd go the modern ones, but 2 is very good.
Okay, cool. Ironfall Invasion also came out, the third-person shooter from VD Dev that seems like Nintendo was publishing it, or not that they were, but it seemed like during the Direct that this was actually a Nintendo-published game, but it actually turned out to be a completely independent title. It's a third-person shooter, has single-player and multiplayer modes. It takes advantage of the new 3DS. I'm not going to get it, but it's cool that it exists. It's notable enough to mention it here out of respect, but it's not for me. I'm not really interested in a shooter on a handheld unless it's with full twin stick action. Like, Killzone Mercenary is the only like full on shooter that I've ever been 100% comfortable with on any kind of handheld ever, even including Metroid Prime Hunters and Moon and all those other attempts at it. Like, I think Kid Icarus kind of counts, but that's even more of a Star Fox game almost in some ways, like the shooter parts. I would argue, like, until Nintendo puts out a handheld that has, like, full twin-stick functionality and isn't a nub, that's when we're going to have our first Nintendo shooter that's really, really worth going, okay, I need to play this. But who knows, maybe this game's awesome. I haven't heard that yet.
To me, shooters, because they are kind of the same at a fundamental level, to me it's much more about the spectacle. Mm-hmm. So it's hard for me to imagine going back and playing a shooter today that has the power of, like, a GameCube game. You know what I mean? Like, I can't... Yep. It's hard for me. I don't enjoy the gameplay enough that alone would let me overlook, like, sort of kind of crummy graphics in a way. You know, whereas other genres of game, I'm totally on board with no matter what they look like on the 3DS. I mean, I love Fire Emblem Awakening. Characters don't even have feet. You know, like, that doesn't bother me. You know, it's mostly little, like, sprites except for the battle animations. And, like, still, like, that's totally fine. But, yeah, shooters to me just don't translate to being, like, downsized to a handheld. Except for the Vita, of course, which has the horsepower to make them look at least somewhat modern. But
even then, like, almost every single attempt at this has been squandered. Like, Uncharted's good. And Killzone's pretty good, but Resistance Burning Skies and Call of Duty Black Ops Declassified.
Oh, yeah, that was really bad.
Real bad games that are... And by the way, Call of Duty Black Ops Declassified, if you want a really horrible game that's 50 minutes long, you can spend $10 on that this week on the PlayStation Store. And by the way... I'm guessing its online probably isn't even active anymore, so all you're left with is really the 50-minute single-player campaign. So maybe you could do worse than Ironfall Invasion.
Yeah, fair enough.
But hey, Killzone's dope. Moving on to news. Investors meeting. The third week in a row we're talking about investor stuff. The Q&A came out, the translation for the Q&A came out on Tuesday, and Nintendo has a pretty... few good tidbits on it. They noted that Nintendo is frustrated with video games, that they're frustrated that there's this resistance to changing, and like they don't like how gaming's like kind of stagnant. So they want to go out of their way to redefine video games, and more than that, redefine entertainment. And the quality of life is going to be their first main attempt at that, but it's not necessarily going to be just health stuff. They want to expand. They want to do more. And they want to make video games more than they have been in the past. And that's not to say they're distancing themselves from traditional video games. Like, Iwata made that very clear. He has this quote that, our strategy for the next 10 years is to change the definition of entertainment and expand the area that Nintendo can do business in. So it's not going to be, like, instead of video games, it's going to be more than video games. And that seems pretty cool. They talked about the new 3DS XL, and they talked about why they held it back to US and Europe for 2015. And as many of us probably expected, it was the result of stock issues. That they could have probably put it out in US and Europe in 2014, holiday 2014, but it would have been even more constrained stock than it is now. And with Japan, it turned out it was just easier to sell it in Japan and Europe, or excuse me, Japan and Australia, because they're closer to China where the systems are being made. So
it gets there faster. Yeah, they restock faster. Yeah.
Right. Which makes sense. That they Iwata admitted, like, we made the wrong decision here. Not like they made the wrong decision, but they should have been well prepared and that it was a difficult decision. They said, in hindsight, the actual results and reactions to the launch of Nintendo 3DS tell me that, yes, we would have actually sold way more if we put this out in the holiday. It actually did pretty well in North America, even compared to Japan, which he also noted, like, part of the reason why the new 3DS didn't do so well in Japan was because, like, Japan is, like, a lot more one-track, so instead of, like, Japan having plenty of people buying Wii U and 3DS, a lot of people were focused either on Wii U or 3DS, so the other one didn't get Japan's complete focus. They said that it's also noted that the new 3DS launching in Japan last Christmas did it took focus away from the Wii U. That's the main point here. Lastly, he said that the Wii U could only need one game to turn its tides around. Following the generally accepted theory of platform life cycles, it is natural for you to presume that the sales of the Nintendo 3DS will drop X percent each year, or we cannot expect a huge increase in Wii U sales. However, on another front, we have witnessed one single software title completely change the entire picture of our business many times. Now, for this, I ask you, Scott, if it wasn't Smash Bros., and it wasn't Smash Bros., if it wasn't Mario 3D Land, and it was not Mario 3D Land, and if it wasn't Nintendo Land, and it was not Nintendo Land, all that's left is Zelda, Animal Crossing, and any new, super new ideas that they have left. Do you think one of those games has the potential to actually go, holy shit, I need a Wii U? Because Zelda being, like, one of the greatest games of all time is the only thing I can think of.
Yeah, it has to be Zelda. Like, that's really it at this point. Like you said, they've tried a lot of different, like, quirky things. Nintendo Land, they even brought Wii Sports to Wii U to no avail.
Which did nothing, yeah.
Right, to sort of try to capture what made the Wii so successful. But people had already moved on by that point. I mean, you know, I don't know that anyone's pining to play more Wii Sports. So it's totally Zelda. And I think that ties back into sort of how I feel the TV show should be handled that we're hearing might be produced for Netflix, is tie it to the game. Like, get that many more people interested in wanting to check out the game. Like, it's fine if you have a Zelda TV series that it's its own thing. But if you can somehow tie into the game and get people into the show, then maybe people are thinking, wow, I need to get a Wii U because I need to see the rest of the story. I need to see the side of the story I'm not seeing in this Netflix series. So I need to get this game. Like, to me, you're reaching a whole new audience and then pulling them in to the Wii U. Like, that, to me, that's the only way to do it. If they don't do that, I don't know what they can release that everyone's going to suddenly look at and go, wow, I need to get the Wii U. I don't know that they can ever have, like, a Halo situation where Halo came out, everyone was like, holy shit, this Xbox is for real. Like, we need to get Xboxes right now.
Right.
I don't know if they can do that.
I don't know if they can either. it's really down to how good and how far-reaching Zelda is. Because I think a lot of like what happened with Skyrim, not to say Elder Scrolls wasn't huge in the past or big in the past, but Skyrim kind of took Elder Scrolls' popularity to the next level. Yeah. I remember being in high school at the time, and like everyone I knew, like even if they weren't normally into video games, was talking about how many hours they dropped in Skyrim. Like, it was an enormous, like, actually Halo-tier game. So I hope Zelda becomes that, not just because I want the Wii U sales to improve, but more because I think it would be so cool if, for the first time since Wind Waker, a Zelda game came out in which people played it and immediately went, holy shit, this could be one of the best games ever.
Yeah.
Because like, Link Between Worlds, as good as some people said it was, I don't think that many people are talking about it anymore. Skyward Sword had a lot of fluff in it, even though it was also an amazing game, I think. It didn't quite reach that, and then Twilight Princess certainly didn't reach that. I hope this is the Zelda that changes everything for the first time since Wind Waker, especially since it's an open-world game. There's a lot more potential for that. It would be so nice to like be around during that. Like, if everyone just starts freaking out about Zelda again.
Yeah.
That would be really nice.
Yeah.
Moving on to the next story, Mario Party sales. The series sales came out. 39 million worldwide, which means that Mario Party is a pretty high-tiered Nintendo franchise. Because, for 15 million games, or excuse me, for 15 games, probably, in the series, because there's 10 main ones. There's GBA, DS, 3DS, so maybe even 13 games.
13, probably, yeah.
That's 3 million per game on average. Now, like, the Wii ones probably sold, like, 5 or 6, and then maybe the GBA one sold, like, 0.8. But it's 3 million on average per game. Like, a lot of games that are coming out now, AAA, like, mass-market games, don't reach that.
Yeah.
So, at the very least, like, Mario Party is clearly an A-minus or B-plus Nintendo franchise, which I never knew before. Because, like, we always hear about Mario Party. It seems like this eternal Nintendo thing. But I don't think a lot of people, especially myself, has really thought about how well of a series it actually performs. Like, it's just not something you think about it. You don't think about it the same way you think about it for Smash Bros. Or Pokemon. Like, but so now it's nice to have a number attached to it where, at the very least, this is a major Nintendo franchise, and there's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. And then also, just something worth adding, is that the Mario Gold Amiibo was confirmed. Hopefully they make them enough for Walmart. They won't. And then that'll be that.
Yeah, that's pretty much right. I mean, have you already seen the screenshots of the Gold Amiibo now on eBay already?
Yeah, it's like $150. We don't even know how many they're gonna make. Nintendo probably doesn't even know how many they're gonna make like in this exact moment. Wow, $150 for a theoretical product.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, this is silly to me. This is the first one where it's, like, totally fluff. Like, if you're really pining to get this, then you are just out of your mind. Like, I can see trying to get every single individual one, especially if you're worried you won't be able to get to, like, use it in a game where it has implementation. Like, I'm playing Kirby the Rainbow Curse right now, and it's like, yeah, it'd be kind of cool to have King Dedede and Meta Knight and be able to use them in the game. But they are so rare that I will never have them. And I'm not that worried about getting them. But this gold Mario Amiibo, it's like, come on, there's already going to be two different Mario Amiibo now that you can collect. Like, you don't need this gold one. So if you're really freaking out over it, like, you've lost your mind. And I'm okay with it being exclusive for that reason, because it's not the only Mario. Like, it's fine to have a collector's item as long as people can have access to a non-special version that still has the same use. So I don't mind it being exclusive. I don't mind the gold thing, but people really got to let it go. Like, this isn't the same thing as Amiibo people. Everyone wants not being stocked, like just regular random Amiibo. So.
Yep. It's, I guess we were talking about this before the show, but I'm kind of on the outside of this. Like, I have a little Mac Amiibo and I have a Pikachu Amiibo, and I really want a Villager Amiibo if they ever make more, and then also like a Captain Falcon and Charizard one maybe. But outside of that, those are the only five Amiibos I would probably ever want that I think would get made. Like, I don't think they're going to make a Duck Hunt one, even though I really hope they do. A Gold Amiibo does sound like weirdly appealing to like the... don't get me wrong, I'm not going to wait anywhere. It's just, if they make enough, then I have Walmarts around me, at least at home. If I'm going to buy a Mario Amiibo at all, and Mario is obviously going to be the most compatible Amiibo to any Nintendo software that exists, why wouldn't I get the gold one?
If you can, yeah.
Right.
My approach to Amiibo at this point has been, like, if I'm just casually on Twitter and I see, like, one of those several Amiibo Twitter accounts go, like, hey, like, GameStop has the Mega Man Amiibo available now for order, and I've got the money, like, oh, okay, well, then I'll order that. But I'm not going to, like, scour the web trying to find it. I'm not going to go on eBay. I'm not going to wait at stores at, like, 8 a.m. It's like, if I'm somewhere and I see it, like, I'll pick one up because I do like them. But in no way is this going to, like, take over my life, or I'm going to have to, like, I really want a Shulk, but I'm not buying one secondhand. I'm not that worried about it. If I see one, I see one. If not, you know, I'll survive.
That sounds like a plan. Let's close. Let's close on the PAX East lineup. Nintendo announced this morning their lineup for PAX East. And the reason why this is a little newsworthy for everyone, regardless of whether you're going to PAX East or not, is that Nintendo wasn't at PAX East last year. And I was surprised, and I actually thought it was a mistake that it leaked from the – not even leaked because it's PAX East, but it kind of came out that Nintendo had a space on the booth for. Like, I just assumed it was a mistake at first. But Nintendo is actually appearing. They're going to have the E3 build for Splatoon. They're going to have Codename Steam. They're going to have Monster Hunter and Majora's Mask 3D, which, yeah, of course they will. They're going to have Xenoblade Chronicles X, which is the one game I'm really looking forward to trying out. And they're going to have Puzzles and Dragons Z and Super Mario Bros. Will be there. Except I think Puzzles and Dragons Z, if you want that, that'll only be at Gung Ho's booth. And then they said that there's going to be some stuff for players who want to put their amiibos on and then fight each other in Smash Bros. 3DS. So that's all cool. I remember PAX East 2012, and that was a couple months after I came to the site. And that was a really fun time, just Nintendo's booth there, because they gave out just free to whoever wanted it. They gave out a Kid Icarus t-shirt, which I still actually have somewhere in my room, and I actually still wear it sometimes. They gave out a huge Xenoblade poster, and they gave out some lanyards, and then they gave out some other stuff too if you wanted it. And then, like, it slowly decreased. Like, in 2013, they gave out, like, specific prizes on each day. I think the one I remember is a Wii U bag, like one of those spaghetti string bags. And I think I might actually have that around – oh, here it is, actually. All right, here it is, the Wii U tote bag. The not tote bag, but the spaghetti string one. They gave this out in 2013. So that was really cool. 2014, they just straight didn't show up, and then that was the first year we didn't get our panel at the same time.
Yeah.
So that was a double whammy. Though we actually have a really good episode from PAX East and Connectivity, if you want to listen to that, where we actually did this real bootleg. We went off to a corner, and then we actually recorded our own pirate panel of the game shows, and we actually got fans of the site. It was a real fun time, and then we had some end-of-day stuff, too. So listen to that episode if you're interested. Now, this year, it's kind of like bittersweet because we still don't have our panel because it seems like PAX East just isn't interested in Nintendo panels really anymore or specialized Nintendo ones. But at the same time, Nintendo's coming. So we'll see how it goes. Speaking of which, something I want to close this show on is that we are going to be at PAX East. Scott is going to be enjoying his time in sunny Florida.
That's right.
But it's
all that snow.
But I'm going to be there. Neil's going to be there. Zach Miller, Zach Kaplan, Addison Webb, Jared. And I think that's everyone. But and then even more people maybe. So there's going to be people. I'm so sorry to any staffer who watches this and I forgot. But we're all going to be there. We're going to have gatherings. We're going to play video games together. We're going to get Chinese food on Saturday that you're probably welcome to join us on. It's fans always are. And then it's going to be a good time. So if you see us there, feel free to say hi. Watch the site because we're going to have a lot of dope content. And then that's Nintendo World Report's Nintendo News Report for Thursday, February 26, 2015. I'm Alex Kalafi. He's Scott Thompson. Tell us what you like. Tell us what you didn't like in the comments. We'll see you next week.
Bye. Bye. All right, guys, that will do it for episode 170 of Connectivity. As always, you can send us listener mail to connectivity@nintendoworldreport.com. If you can, please rate and review us on iTunes, and be sure to follow us on Twitter. Go to nintendoworldreport.com, look for the Twitter sidebar on the right-hand side of the page, and you'll find all of our usernames there. And if you'd like, please stick around now for a bonus segment all about dinosaurs with myself and Zach. We'll see you next week. Segment of Connectivity. I'm Scott Thompson, and today I'm with Zach Miller.
Yo, yo!
And that means it's fucking dinosaur time. Yeah. Alright. When's the last time we did a dinosaur talk? Do you remember?
I don't. It's been a really long time.
Yeah.
I wanted to do one on the telethon, but Johnny got in before I did.
Oh, right. So it has been quite some time, but the segment is not extinct. See what I did? That's like the extent of my dinosaur knowledge. So that's all I got for you. So we've got some questions from some listeners of the show, and Zach's gonna do his best to teach us all about dinosaurs. That is the goal here.
That's what I do.
So let's start off. This one came from Duck Hunt Dog, not the actual dog, but a listener on Twitter. And he writes, I'm curious about the high radioactivity of dinosaur bones. And in parentheses, he puts, how and why? Please discuss. So, Zach, is that a thing? I mean, dinosaur bones have high radioactivity?
Dinosaur bones in the American Southwest, or not Southwest, but yeah, Southwest, have a high, they're much higher radioactive, much more radioactive than the surrounding rocks. And, Nobody knows why. And the rocks aren't just the bones are, and they're not dangerous. You can still prospect for them and prepare them in a lab and you're not going to get radiation poisoning. But, one of the interesting side effects of this is that, they will glow in the dark under a black light.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So if you are, there's a story in one of my books, these preparators were having a real hard time differentiating the bones of a big sauropod dinosaur called Seismosaurus from the surrounding rock because they were the same color. And only the texture was different. But that still made it difficult to see, to tell the difference. And somebody put a black light up against them and the bones glow blue.
That's neat, but so there's just no explanation for it. And this is only in the American Southwest, not in other regions where bones have been discovered?
No, only in this specific formation called the Morrison Formation. And the Seismosaurus that I'm talking about is from New Mexico. But you get them across that band of the American Southwest.
Now, well, do you think this has less to do with the bones themselves and something found in the environment or in the environment at the time that these bones, you know, these dinosaurs existed?
It's got to be. Okay. It's got to have something to do with the, because when a bone fossilizes, it's every molecule of the organic bone is replaced by minerals. So, or that's traditionally thought how it works. So it must have been some kind of radioactive mineral that invaded the bone tissue at the time of fossilization over a long period of time. But I can't begin to speculate about how or why. That's way outside my area of expertise. But it's cool, and you get glow-in-the-dark bones out of it.
Could it have been a meteor?
Could it? Oh, yeah. Like, oh, I see. It deposited a layer of radioactive material.
Yeah.
Hey, why not? I'll take that. Sure.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Cool. So, I mean, maybe basically dinosaurs almost could have been like the Hulk then. Like, they just had gamma radiation. These specific dinosaurs.
Yeah, that would explain why sauropods got so big.
There you go.
Yeah.
I think we cracked it.
I like that.
Zach, you need to write a paper about this immediately.
I do.
Get that shit published. It's your big break. Did you ever think about, like, I mean, academically really pursuing something with the study of dinosaurs? I mean, is this just purely a hobby for you?
It is purely a hobby. We don't have a paleontology degree program in Alaska, at least not when I was in school. And, I don't know, when I was growing up, I was here, my doctor was here, you know, I have cystic fibrosis, so moving is a restricted thing for me.
Mm-hmm.
And back then I just didn't really have the resources to go to a school for paleontology, and also doing field work would kill me. All the dust in the air and the sun, and, it would not be that great for me. But I am pursuing something academically, right now. I don't want to say anything until it's for sure.
But yeah, you don't want like an evil scientist to scoop up your research or anything.
Oh, nothing like that. Nothing like that. Nobody's going to scoop anything up. It's not research based.
Okay.
It's not academic research. But I'm of the mindset that if I say anything to anybody about it before, ink is signed, it's not going to happen.
Is it related to dinosaurs?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. Awesome.
Yeah, I'll tell you about it after the show.
Oh, shit. Look at that, you guys. I got that insider info.
Yeah, you got the exclusive.
That's Dinogate.
Yeah, look for something out of me in the next few years. How about that?
If that's all awesome. Goes well. That is a lengthy tease. That is a multi-year long tease.
I've been working on it for over a year now.
Wow, that's fantastic.
I mean, I'm not having kids. This is my legacy.
Well, that's good. That's a heck of a legacy.
Yeah.
Like, I always thought, like, yeah, you must have at least wanted to or were, like, pursuing something to a higher degree than just liking dinosaurs.
I've always wanted to leave my mark in the field somehow.
Because, I mean, like, so these bonus segments, we do the space one with Johnny, but it's like he went to school for that, and that's, like, his profession, right? And, like, for this to just be a hobby, like, it your dedication to it. Yeah, it would suggest that you wanted something more than just to be a fan of dinosaurs.
Very much. So. I used to be really involved with the Alaska Museum of Natural History here in Anchorage until we had kind of a philosophical falling out.
Oh.
Did
it become a creationist museum?
Oh, no, not like nothing like that, no. But it became kind of a, you know, I wanted them to be an academic kind of field museum. If you've ever been to the Chicago Field Museum.
Yeah, of course.
They have an opportunity to be a real educational place. And I thought they should go that way. And they said, we have a lot of birthday parties here. You can touch everything. That's just the way it is.
More entertainment.
More entertainment. And I just kind of...
Have you been to the Field Museum in Chicago?
Oh, many times. I love it. Oh, my God. I love
good,
it.
Good, good. Yeah.
I was there before and after Sue.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Sue, for people who don't know, it's the big T-Rex, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. Because they have a few dinosaurs there, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, they have a dinosaur hall, and they have a brachiosaur outside on the, I don't know, second floor.
And that's what I've sent you, like, during when the Blackhawks are doing well and getting far in the playoffs. They put Blackhawk jerseys on all the dinosaurs, which is pretty
God.
Great.
Oh, God.
Hey, come on. That's, like, the convergence of our two
I'll
loves.
Take that.
I think we
yeah,
have
I'll
to appreciate that.
That.
Yeah, I mean, growing up outside of Chicago, we always took field trips to the Field Museum.
Nice.
So I've been there a bunch as well. So it's
now, if you ever, Scott and all our listeners, if you ever have an opportunity, to go to Canada. You should go to Alberta and a little town called Drumheller, which has the world's best dinosaur museum. It's called the Royal Tyrrell Museum of Paleontology. It is so great. Oh, now, my God.
Were a lot of fossils found up in Canada? Or is
Alberta
that just,
is a...
like a hotbed of...
a hotbed of dinosaur research.
Okay, cool.
They got all the dinosaurs.
Nice. Well, I know we have Canadian listeners, so maybe some people have gone or can go. Yeah. I'm, like, terrible with geography, so I have no idea where someone living in Canada, how close they would be to Alberta.
Good question.
If you're nearby.
Alberta's great. I think it's kind of in the middle of the country.
Okay.
Borders the United States.
And so you've been there, too?
Yeah, I've been there twice. And they've recently, in the last few years, they've renovated it, and I really want to go back. It's a phenomenal museum.
That's awesome. Well, yeah, if I ever go, I've always kind of wanted to go on vacation in Canada, so if I'm in that region, maybe that's something I'll do. Well, let's move on to our second question. This comes from Travis Brody, and he says, is that right? Ankylosaurus?
Ankylosaurus.
Ankylosaurus?
Ankylosaurus, really.
Oh, Ankylosaurus? Okay. Yeah. Well, yeah, just tell me how to pronounce it, right? they are awesome. That's all he wrote.
Yeah, I think we've gotten this from him before. Ankylosaurs are awesome. You know, they're the armored dinosaurs.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I remember we talked about them before. You're right.
With clubs on their tails.
Yes. Yeah.
There's a lot of ankylosaurs. There's some that don't have a club on their tail, but they just have a lot of spikes along the sides of their bodies and their tail. And then you have kind of a middle ground one that doesn't have any spikes, but has a more armored head, and it's got really big, long, curved spikes coming off of the shoulders. And we have one in Alaska called Edmontonia. Guess where it was first found?
Could it be Edmonton?
I wonder. Yeah.
Were these dinosaurs? Were they carnivores?
No, they were herbivores.
That's what I figured, and so that was all just for defense, basically.
Yeah, and they're super short. They're really big. Ankylosaurus itself was 30 feet long, but they're really low to the ground, and they're really slow moving, so you could outrun them, and you could, I don't know, get above them, and they wouldn't see you, and yeah, they're purely defensive, although the ones with clubs on their tails, you know, speaking of Sue at the Field Museum, she has a broken lower leg bone that was probably caused by being smashed by an ankylosaur club.
Wow.
It's right at the right height.
Huh, that's pretty neat. I wonder if that's what led to that, to Sue dying eventually.
Yeah, that's a good question. And in fact, in the same area, another slightly smaller Tyrannosaurus found, not nearly as complete, just bits and pieces, and then two juveniles. So you wonder if it was a family.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, that's cool. And, you know, that I feel like that's a very popular dinosaur. I mean, as soon as you describe it, like, I'm picturing that dinosaur in my head. So I know I've seen it represented in, you know, like, more popular depiction.
Oh, Ankylosaurus?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Of the Ankylosaurus.
You know,
yeah.
Another interesting thing about Ankylosaurus is that it is very poorly known. I don't know if any material has been definitively assigned to it since it was originally discovered in I want to say early 1900s. But there's the one you're probably thinking of. All the dinosaur toys say Ankylosaurus, all the books say Ankylosaurus. But the most numerous ankylosaur known from the best remains, tons of skeletons, is called Euoplacephalus. And it looked a lot like Ankylosaurus. It was basically a smaller version, but it is super common. It's all over the place. And it also had a club on its tail and armor on its back, and it's most of our knowledge of Ankylosaurus has come from Euoplacephalus.
Okay. Now, given the fact that you said no material has really been like discovered or about about this dinosaur, is there a chance there could be discovery and everything we know about it is completely wrong, or do we have enough to go off of that we know it existed as we believe?
We've got enough to know that it did not differ strongly from Euplocephalus and other North American ankylosaurs. You know, one of the things that is you can never, almost never really know is how the armor was arranged on their backs. Because it's just embedded in the skin. It's not attached to the rest of the skeleton. So a lot of depictions of ankylosaurs you see in books and in toys is largely speculative.
I feel like a lot of times they just kind of look like turtles.
Yeah, definitely. They had the same idea. Yeah, they just didn't have armor on their bellies.
Right.
Yeah, although one in Australia did have armor on its belly.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was little. It was only 6 feet long or so. Yeah.
Cool. Let's move on to our third question. This comes from the good Dr. Johnny Metz, who we've already talked about. And I don't know if this is in jest or if this was a serious question.
Yeah, I couldn't tell if it was in jest either. Yeah.
He asks if aquatic dinosaurs are the precursor to penguins.
Okay.
And your response would be?
My response would be, I think if it's not in jest, if it's serious, and let's assume for the listeners it is, he's kind of confusing three different scenarios. The first will go into aquatic dinosaurs. There are no aquatic dinosaurs. There were semi-aquatic dinosaurs like Spinosaurus and its cousins, Spinosauroids. But if he's talking about things like ichthyosaurs and plesiosaurs and mosasaurs, those are not dinosaurs. You've seen an ichthyosaur, right, Scott?
Probably.
They're like the dolphin shaped.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Marine reptiles. Yeah. Yep. So their closest relative is a lizard. They're like a super well adjusted for water lizard.
Okay.
They even gave live birth.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Like a dolphin. And then plesiosaurs are the ones that have fat bodies and big flippers and super long necks. Yeah. And they are, they're not related really to anyone living today. They're a very extinct side branch of reptile evolution. And then mosasaurs, which are those big, long-bodied, pointy snouts with teeth and they look like giant marine lizards, I guess is what I'd say. And they are lizards. They're related to, monitor lizards. And they existed at the end of the late Cretaceous, all over the world, but they really, were in North America quite a bit. So those guys are all, none of them are related to dinosaurs at all, except they're reptiles too.
Did they live at the same time as dinosaurs?
Yes, they did. Yes, they all lived in kind of, ichthyosaurs came first and then plesiosaurs came on the scene. They lived together for a while. And then they both started to go extinct by the time Mosasaurs were really late to the party. They got here in the late Cretaceous, or the early Cretaceous, I should say, and they were extinct when the dinosaurs went extinct.
Oh, okay. They showed up and they burned out quickly, I guess.
Yeah, just like horned dinosaurs.
Yeah.
So that's the first issue. So there are no aquatic dinosaurs. And were they the precursor to penguins? Well, penguins are birds. So the precursor to a penguin is a bird, or is also a bird. I'm serious. There's some old school thought that different lineages of, say, dinosaurs or different lineages of bird may have originated from different groups of reptiles, that they didn't have a common ancestry. But, of course, birds do. And the ancestors of penguins would have been semi-aquatic birds, probably like a loon or any seabird you see up here today, murres maybe, or cormorants. So the ancestors of penguins are semi-aquatic birds. And, of course, birds, the ancestors of birds, are small land-based carnivorous dinosaurs. So that's, I don't know, like, I don't know how deep you wanted me to get into that, but I try to get into it.
There you go.
Cover all the bases, you know.
Absolutely.
Scott, did you know there was a penguin that was 6 feet tall?
I did not know that, but that's awesome.
Was it's
that
the extinct
penguin?
Now.
Was yep, that the penguin but... in Mario 64?
Yes. It's I think it's from the tip of South America.
Oh wow, weird. Okay. That's cool. Well, how long ago was that? I mean, are we talking like hundreds of years ago, or are we talking in the past like century?
Oh, millions of years ago.
Oh, okay. I thought
after
I thought it
the
was...
dinosaurs died out, but it was during the age of, you know, when really big mammals were around.
Okay, so it was a whole species of 6 foot penguin.
Yeah,
I thought
you
were just telling me that there was a freak penguin like 20 years ago that was 6 feet tall for some
like
reason.
The mighty Joe Young of penguins.
Exactly. Yeah. It's like I'm really excited about that. Or even like the King Kong of penguins.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
So let's move on. So Neil and I had basically the same question for you. And again, this illustrates to you our the beginning and end of our dinosaur knowledge compared to these great questions that we got from listeners. So the Jurassic Park, Jurassic World trailer has come and gone. There's been a few now. And it seems a crux of the movie is going to be the fact that Chris Pratt basically trains raptors to perform like in shows for park goers,
and, or park security apparently.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, it seems like I mean, it's kind of a bummer to already know this, but the trailer very much suggests that he's going to be using these raptors to like fight a crazy
sci-fi dinosaur.
Yeah, I don't want to say like mutated dinosaur, but it right isn't it like a splice of two different
It's a splice of several different breeds of dinosaurs. Something you'd see on the Sci-Fi Channel.
Exactly. I don't know how I feel about that so much.
Me neither.
But
they're
yeah,
just going all monster movie now. Yeah. They're not even giving a shit anymore.
But so what do you think about that concept, the idea of training raptors?
Well, you can certainly train.
I mean, we train a lot of dangerous animals today, so it doesn't
seem
impossible.
We train a lot of dangerous, and we train a lot of birds. And now raptors did not have the relative brain size that a parrot does or a raven does, a bird you would train today. I don't think you can train things like, you know, ostriches or emus. I think they're just both too dumb to be trained.
Right. But I wonder if within the lore of Jurassic Park, if this makes sense, because we've been like led to believe that within Jurassic Park, like raptors are like the smartest animal.
Within the lore of Jurassic Park, it does make sense, especially given, according to Jurassic Park 3, their brains look a lot like a dog brain. Yeah. Within the lore, I think it'll work. And, oh God, that movie.
I mean, what's your feeling about it? Are you excited? Is it, for you, is it kind of like the way you'd be excited to see, like, a really bad movie? Like, are you expecting
it's
it to
that.
Be sort of
yeah,
a disaster?
It's that. It's disappointing to me because the first Jurassic Park really prided itself on being super up to date, and it single-handedly pulled people's perception of dinosaurs out of the 60s and the 70s. Into this modern era where dinosaurs are hot-blooded and you know move a lot and are not just these tail-dragging behemoths, and you know prior Jurassic Park that discussion had been largely academic, but Jurassic Park just, I mean, we still use it as a cultural touchstone today. Like when people think about dinosaurs now, they think about Jurassic Park. So I think Jurassic World had an opportunity to kind of be that second revolution where we suddenly see, you know, dinosaurs with feathers. Because people still don't know that. That's an academic discussion as well. But I think Jurassic Park had an opportunity to pull everyone's knowledge to the present about dinosaurs, and I'm disappointed that they're not doing that.
Right, it really seems like they're not doing that. Yeah, based on all
kind of on purpose too, right? It feels like they're trying to cash in on your nostalgia for Jurassic Park 1.
Well, right, that's what it like. I mean, same thing. Like we said, the lore of Jurassic Park. It seems very much a movie built to cash in on that. Yeah,
yeah. They like even Jessica, is it Jessica Chastain or somebody else?
Yeah.
It's,
Jessica Chastain.
Okay, it's
yeah.
her. Like, she's wearing white all the time. I think she's got a cane. She may as well be John Hammond. You know, I think it's a missed opportunity. But I'm treating it as a monster movie. And, you know, I'll see it opening day because it's dinosaurs.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, it's dinosaurs. But I think they missed the boat on it. I will say out of all the stupid Jurassic Park stuff in Jurassic World in the trailer, the only thing that really pisses me off is that there's a scene where, like, somebody's like, you know, everybody run! And this whole crowd's running through the park trying to get out, and all these pteranodons are swooping down and grabbing people. It, just like in Jurassic Park 3, that happened in the pteranodon scene. Well, pteranodons weigh half as much as you or me. They're super lightweight animals.
Right.
You could kill them by hitting them with a baseball bat.
Yeah.
You'd break every bone in their body. So that just, oh.
The swooping down and grabbing, yeah, like at least 160-pound people, if not, you know, more than
and
that.
Not heavier. So yeah. Like the raptors, I'm tentatively okay with because, yeah, it's from the first movie. They don't have feathers. All right. I'm okay with that. Even their super predator dinosaur, I'm like, well, this is kind of where they were headed.
Right, yeah.
I
like
mean, come
gene
on.
Gene splicing and all this kind of
yeah,
stuff.
Gene yeah, gene splicing, and why not create a super monster? Although, you know, it does give me pause. I'm like, it did have to grow up. Didn't they realize this might have been a bad idea during all the years it was growing up? But, like, the pterosaurs hauling off people, for some reason, that's really sticking with me.
What about, too, we see, speaking of aquatic dinosaurs, we see that scene where it's almost like a SeaWorld kind of thing. Like,
oh,
this big, like, whale.
That's what a mosasaur is, Scott.
Oh,
that's
okay.
A mosasaur.
Okay.
Okay, so that mosasaur is the size of a goddamn blue whale, if we're using the shark for scale. Somebody did this online. They were like, well, if this, the shark's this big, and it's being eaten by a thing this big, then holy shit. They did not get anywhere near that big. The biggest mosasaur is 40 feet long.
Okay, so it's big,
as
but
big
not...
as a T-Rex.
Yeah.
It's basically the T-Rex of the ocean.
Yeah. But that thing is giant in the trailer.
Yeah, it's... How do they keep it? Where does it live?
It's a very good question.
And how did they get marine reptile DNA out of a mosquito? These are all questions I found it's best not to ask.
Yeah. Now, are you able to sort of turn your brain off a little bit and still enjoy it, even though you have such a great love for dinosaurs? Or is it going to be hard for you in this case, you think?
Let's say this. The first time I see it, I will enjoy it. I'll think it's dumb, but I'll enjoy it. But then subsequent times I watch it, I'll just be shaking my head. Because that's what I did with Jurassic Park 3. The first time I saw Jurassic Park 3, I was like, this is stupid, but it's enjoyable. Mm. And every time I see it now, I'm like, oh my God, who got paid for this?
Yeah, I'm interested to see how the movie turns out. My big problem is, and like something similar like with like the Alien versus Predator movies, well, at least the first one, not the second one, is I don't really like the idea of taking this character that we've come or to fear and making it sort of a hero. So I don't really like the idea of him teaming up with the raptors. I thought that was a big problem with Alien versus Predator when you have, like, the Predator becomes the good guy. That's not how the Predator has been framed throughout, like, the lore of the
and
Predator.
And mentors some random lady.
Right, exactly. Like, I don't like that.
No.
And I know they got that from a comic book series. There's a comic and book series where that very thing happens, and she ends up joining, like, the Predator race and going into space and all kinds of nonsense. But I don't like that, and I don't really like the idea of the raptors, which were the most terrifying dinosaur in that, you know, the original movies, sort of being, like, good guys now. But
yeah. Yeah, that's true. I hadn't thought of that, but you're right. That it kind of – it really decreases their scariness factor. But, man – I tell you, in that first teaser trailer is like a minute long. It closes with Chris Pratt riding through the woods on a moped with a bunch of raptors. I'm like, okay, I don't even care anymore. I'll watch that.
I know. It's like great in like the just the dumbest, most like basic way.
And I like, I just love the lines in that movie when Jessica Chastain says, or whatever her name is, says to him, yeah, we created a hybrid dinosaur, and it, well, wouldn't you know it, it got out, and now it's hunting people. He's like, that was a bad idea.
Yeah, I know.
Somebody online suggested that the movie would be even better if he and his dialogue was replaced with Aubrey Plaza.
Oh, yeah.
I like that idea a lot.
That would be pretty great.
So there you go. Okay. Jurassic World, yeah.
So, yeah, and for everyone listening, we will be doing a Jurassic World segment after the movie comes out. We've seen it. I'm sure Zach will have a lot to discuss. and he will fix your brain from all the horrible things it's taught you about dinosaurs. So, thank you to everyone who wrote in questions. You can always send in more dinosaur questions to connectivity@intelligibleport.com, where you can tweet them to us. The more questions we get, the sooner we'll do another one. But if we don't do another one before then, definitely after Jurassic World. So, thank you, Zach, for being here. I'm sure I had to really twist your arm to get you to come here and talk about dinosaurs.
Oh, yeah. It's always tough.
And we will talk to you guys later.
Bye.
Bye.